Our next presenter is Dr. Pat Nolan. She teaches medical students community health at Brown University. She's executive director of the Rhode Island Public Health Institute and formerly a state health official.
Thank you very much for having me. This paper is a preliminary report actually on the administrative side of a survey that we have been developing to look not at the state or national level, but at the neighborhood level. My partners in crime can't be here this week because there's only a certain amount of money to travel, and I paid my own way, so it's their problem. But Carol Hall Walker is in charge of a number of chronic disease programs and other activities at the State Health Department, and she is our program officer for the community block grant. For the prevention block grant. And Karine Monteiro is an epidemiologist who's been working on contract with the organization I'm from, the Rhode Island Public Health Institute. And Dr. Bob Marshall is also at the Health Department and is part-time with the Rhode Island Public Health Institute. My commercial financial relationship is largely aspirational at this point, but we do hope that the survey process that we've been developing will be a product that others will be willing to pay for. So I wanted my aspirations to be very clear. So what are we working on? Communities are trying hard to describe their own healthcare, their own health problems, and their own environments. They're trying to be part of the system that changes what's going on in their environments. And governments and funders want to know what's the value. And small-scale interventions take a lot of effort to generate that kind of information. Neighborhood data are largely lost in statewide sampling, even in Rhode Island, and certainly all over the country. So we've tried to develop a set of methods for looking at neighborhoods and to work not necessarily in established jurisdictions. So these are neighborhoods, they're not cities, they're not counties, they're not zip codes. They are neighborhoods that people recognize, and they are agglomerations of census blocks. We wanted to try to have a way to compare that data with statistically random sampled data at the state level, and so we have modeled this on the BRFS, as I will describe in a few minutes, in a little bit more detail. The objectives are to get neighborhood-level data that can be used for planning and evaluation in programs, for strategic planning within communities, for grant applications, and for local policy development. We are also trying to arrive at a system of evaluating that is, in fact, affordable, and I will be talking about that. We've worked with the Rhode Island Department of Health. We developed an in-person interview that is based on the Behavior Risk Factor Survey of 2009. And we have conducted approximately 236 interviews in the low-income neighborhood. That was both our training pilot and actual data collection. Our survey is fondly known now as Neighborhood Health Check. And we actually have hats that we wear when we're out in the neighborhood, along with our orange jackets, so people can both see us and ask what we're doing there. We used an adaptation principle to really try to maintain fidelity with the BRFS. We used their modules. We've added a few questions in specific areas to meet specifications. And we used a rigorous sampling frame to support analysis and comparisons. Our survey instrument, as we've constructed it, is using modules on health status, physical activity, nutrition, BMI, heart disease, high blood pressure, cholesterol, cancer, diabetes, tobacco use, income, education, and telephone access, which I'll come back to as well. We added questions on walking distances and perceptions of safety and other neighborhood factors. And we worked very hard to keep this at roughly a 20-minute interview in English or Spanish. We have found that it usually goes to 30 minutes in Spanish because the Dominicans in our town really like to talk. However, we've drawn a random sample of 20% of the blocks in a large area of the city. It's actually five neighborhoods in our city. And we constructed an observational assessment, which we did last summer, based on the active neighborhood checklist of Penner and Bronson from St. Louis, to give us a sense of what the land use and several other factors, including walkability, are in these same neighborhoods. And then we've organized a sample of residential and mixed-use blocks from that original sample in random order. There are about the original, for our interviews, we invited one adult per occupied unit to be interviewed. Our goal is 1,000 interviews in order to be able to pick up some of the rarer events in the neighborhoods, and as I indicated, we're just over 200 at this point. If more than one adult lived in a unit, we are asking that the adult with the most recent birthday be the one who completes the interview, and we have offered a $5 gift card for completing the interview. I'm going to read you this information and show you the picture. We are the smallest state in the Union. We have 1 million people, give or take a few, and just over, we have the highest density rate behind New Jersey. We're very disappointed when they took that over. But the area in blue is the city of Providence. The area in red is the set of neighborhoods in which we have been carrying out this survey. There are 515 blocks in that target area, and our random sample was 103 blocks. Our final sample for interviewing is 98 blocks, which were either residential or mixed residential and commercial. We conducted our pilot training on 4 blocks and completed 22 interviews there. And then our first wave, which were selected in random order, we've completed 15 of 24 blocks. So what was our method? Well, we hired and trained field workers using a scheme of 2-person teams. And we used this same scheme for both the observational survey in summer of 2008 and for the interviews in 2009. Our goal was to have a student and a community person on each 2-person team. It turns out sometimes we have community people who are also students, so the actual mix doesn't look exactly like that. We wanted one man and one woman on each team, especially for the in-home interviews. We felt 2 men was not a good plan. They wouldn't get in the door. And we figured 2 women wasn't a good plan. There are safety concerns. In fact, we have not had a man on every team, but for the most part, we've maintained that 2-person pairing. And we have at least one Spanish speaker as our goal. We didn't quite make that, so occasionally the team will stumble through their interview acquisition line and say, I'll go get my friend, and we will switch in a team. Also, team members cannot interview someone that they know, and since some people are from the neighborhood, we also have to switch teams at that point. And we have conducted our interviews through this last summer. We worked on weekends and daylight hours only. There are some problems with that. We enumerated every residential unit that we could identify on a given block and then began knocking on the doors to invite people to be interviewed. As I indicated, we have completed 15 blocks in our random sample, 75 residential segments, a segment being the street, both sides of the street between two intersections. We enumerated a total of 1,226 residential units. We were able to confirm that 975 units were occupied and 151 units were unoccupied. So it's roughly a 14% vacancy rate in these neighborhoods. That does not include buildings that were so damaged that you can't determine that they are residences at all. But it does include buildings that were either foreclosed and are closed up, but not derelict, and it does include units in our enumeration which were under renovation. We made a total of 1,928 contacts, knocking on doors, to get our 212 interviews. So it took 9 attempts to achieve an interview. We got a sample of interviews from approximately 1 out of 5 occupied units. We had originally projected we would be able to get them for 1 out of 4 units. So we have a small cost problem there. In addition, we looked at what it took to get an interview. We averaged 1.5 contacts in an occupied dwelling to get an interview, 1.56 contacts to get a refusal, so it actually took a little more work, usually because we kept trying until they just said, go away, as opposed to come back tomorrow. And it took 1.2 contacts to determine that the subject was ineligible because of language barriers. We were only able to conduct the interview in English and Spanish. We are not using translators. We are using an English version and an Hispanic version of the survey. Eventually, we would probably want to try to at least have Cambodian and possibly Laotian and Portuguese. And as I indicated, it took 1.38 contacts to determine if a unit was unoccupied. It wasn't enough to just see a sign in the window that said for rent, for example. So what did we find out? Our teams actually worked very well. They were productive, and having the Spanish speaker on each team increased our productivity, we felt, quite substantially, because 1/3 of our interviews were conducted in Spanish, and we felt had we not had that capacity that people who had marginal language skills would have turned us down. In fact, 50%, or roughly 50% of our sample identified as Hispanic, but as I said, only 1/3 wanted to be interviewed in Spanish. We found that field supervision had to be direct for 2 reasons, just to maintain the workload. It was very important to have a supervisor in the field who was constantly updating where we were on the contacts. We weren't going back to the same house when we shouldn't, and so on. And secondly, that allowed us to do a lot of on-site problem solving and decision making. The weekend and daylight working hour worked well. There may be room for doing weekday. We are going to try that this fall. There were certainly problems related to nice days in the summer when people in Rhode Island selectively go to the beach. But unfortunately for them, fortunately for us, we had very few of those this summer. The training is very important. We realized that there are, whoops. that we probably overdid the training, and we've redesigned our training process. We also moved from paper to laptops in the course of this, and it was that made a substantial difference when we were able to do in-field data entry. It was important to do some didactic work, go out in the field, try it, go back, discuss what went wrong. So you have to practice, go and practice, go back. And that is time consuming. We realize that the practice element is really important. So what were the resource issues? Fine-tuning this instrument, it took forever to develop the instrument. It was a combination of working with the community organizations that were supporting this and the health department, statisticians and data people, and our own concepts of what we were trying to accomplish. Drawing the sample was also a very important activity, and it was important for us and the community to understand what sampling meant and why we said, no, we're not going to that house or to that block because we don't want convenience samples, then we can't compare this data with the larger data set. Recruiting and training is sometimes entertaining, and we did a lot of our recruiting through the community agencies with which we were working. And I already mentioned field supervision. Data management was extremely important in several areas. One is managing the surveys themselves, and the other is really managing the data about the residences, the contacts, and in the long run, we are going to make a few changes in how we did that because we think we were collecting some data that we will probably never use. But on the whole, it was a labor-intensive effort, and as we've moved to in-field entry of the data, that has helped a lot. So what did it cost? Our training cost us approximately $2,500 for the 10 teams. Our data collection, establishing all of the data collection activities, cost us about $8,000. So that moved us forward to a slightly higher number than we had originally planned. In our supervision, we found that for 5 teams, we needed 2 supervisors in the field at all times. And field data management actually became considerably less expensive than it was in the original setup time. Our incentives, we paid $5 for every completed interview. Occasionally one can get merchants to donate this, but on the whole, this is not a population that merchants are attracted to, and we tried to get gift certificates to local merchants. Much to my chagrin, the best one turned out to be Walmart. Our epidemiology, it was about, $3,000, which was really cheap. She's a wonderful person. She does a lot of consulting for free. So our total costs for supplies and equipment will be amortized over a much larger population in the future, but it was essentially $7,500. So our cost estimates, it cost us about $20,000 to develop this. That doesn't count a certain amount of volunteer time. The cost for collecting and compiling the data was just under $40,000. So our cost for completed final interviews is approximately $187 per interview. I haven't found out yet how that matches up with BRFS. So in conclusion, We found that we could do an in-person interview structured from the BRFS questions using a door-to-door campaign model. And an interview can be obtained from approximately 20% of the adult residents in a low-income neighborhood. The cost of developing the survey I've already given you. And I've told you most of this data already, and I'd like to just talk for a moment about our next steps. Part of the health department's goals here were to have a feedback mechanism that communities can use for planning, and we're in the process now of developing those sessions to go back with our community partners to give this data to the communities. We also have data about telephone access in this community, which we will be analyzing with the BRFS folks at the State Health Department to look specifically at telephone data capacity and to analyze a number of the issues that are in our data. We have recruited 2 graduate students so far and are looking for more. My thanks to our partners, the Rhode Island Department of Health, to the Prevention Block Grant, and to CHISPA, which is the Center for Hispanic Policy and Advocacy, St. Joseph's Health Services, and St. John Hope Settlement House, who are our community partners.